Well, hey, everybody. I don't have much smart on me, but I do have smart feet. And so they go to a lot of AA meetings, and I introduce myself the AA way. And I also, those of you from the Memphis area know this, in the Memphis television market, I'm privileged to report the 5, 6, and 10 o'clock news. I'm your local yokel television news anchorman on the NBC affiliate. I'm the electronic town crier in Memphis on the NBC affiliate. And so I'm always afraid that I'm going to start the 5, 6, or 10 o'clock news by saying, "Good evening, I'm Joe Birch and I'm an alcoholic." And when I do that, eventually, you know, I think some of our brethren just tune in to see if I do it, and they turn it on. He didn't say it again, so you can turn the channel now. But if and when I do it and you're in the Memphis television market, please drive to 119 Racine Street, home of the Came to Believe group. I have a key. We're going to have a special meeting, and the topic is going to be anonymity. I have to mind my manners. I have to say thank you to Milton for inviting me to this roundup, the Mont Eagle Roundup, and I've been reading about the great history and the legacy of this roundup, the 102nd one here tonight, and what a great, rich history this is. What a beautiful thing this is. So thank you, Milton. Milton has been persistent in inviting me, and I don't generally turn these invitations down. I run to these kinds of things, but I'm in the TV business, and we're in a ratings period. And when we have ratings in February, May, November, and July, it's difficult for me to get here. And so that's why I'm late. I missed last night. I so apologized. And I did get here today at about 2 o'clock, and I walked in, and I walked into the lobby. I'd never been to the convention center here before, the conference center. And I want you to know your speaker from this morning was sitting in the lobby area. Grace was there. And I came in and kind of moseyed around for a minute. And I want to give her credit for her Al-Anon powers, because she didn't do anything for about 5 minutes. And after about 5 minutes, the Al-Anonic personality took over, and she recognized instinctively and intuitively an alcoholic needing help. And she proceeded to give me my pamphlet. She gave me my keys. She gave me all my stuff. She told me how the whole place operates. She told me what time everything's going to be. She made sure I had my badge. You are one great Elena. And not only that, she told me some of her story. So I really feel blessed. So although I missed it, I'm glad I caught you then. That was really a blessing. So thank you very much, Grace, for welcoming me to Mont Eagle. And I want to thank the committee for putting this thing on year after year, and especially this year's committee. I know Philip and Teresa, we have been together in Panama City, Florida. We spoke, I think it was in 2007. And from being around town, Philip was there at my beginnings in AA. He and I have been knowing each other for a while now, going to Central Group in Memphis. So I want to thank everybody. And now I want to apologize to all the people who were at the gratitude dinner last week, because you're going to hear some of the same stuff. I'm going to change it up a little bit, but I had the privilege of speaking at the Memphis Area Intergroup last week, and we had a great crowd and a good success for our intergroup. So God bless Brenda B. and everybody who works for Memphis Area Intergroup. All right, let's get right to the alcoholism. So Joe B.'s 20 years old, and he's got the dry heaves. He's really drunk. He's really sick. He's outside his watering hole, believe it or not, in Teaneck, New Jersey, which is right across the bridge from New York. The first town is Fort Lee. That's where my great-grandfather was the mayor in the early 1900s. The second town is Englewood, and I was born there in 1955. And the third town is Teaneck. It's a little bedroom community in New York City. Most everybody works in the city and comes home and sleeps in the suburban area at night. And I'm 20 years old. I'm home from college in Memphis, of all places, where I came to go to college, and I'll tell you more about that later. But I'm outside my favorite dive bar, which was owned by a guy named Bart Finnegan, an Irish Catholic guy. And Bart owned the Shay Tea Grill, and it's where I started sneaking into when I was 17 years of age. Underage drinking, but back then they were lowering the drinking age because Vietnam War was going on and that sort of thing. And so the GIs who were heading over to Vietnam could have a beer on the way. And guys like me who were underage were sneaking into liquor stores and bars who were alcoholically inclined. And so from the tender age of 17, I started drinking. And now I'm 20, I'm home from college, I've got the dry heaves, there's Joby. Have you ever been so drunk where you can hear what everybody's saying and comprehend what everybody's saying, but you're unable to process words back in order to respond? In other words, to use the English language and communicate. And people began to come out of the bar as I was laying there for I don't know how long, and they said, who is it? Because they didn't recognize me because I was a little bit of a lone wolf and I'd been away in college. I hadn't been around the bar. They said, who is that guy? And I couldn't say anything. And they said, well, should we call an ambulance? I was really sick. I'm there with the dry heaves, you know, all that fun of throwing up nothing, but you can't stop. And I used hand signals to identify my desire not to have an ambulance. And then they said, are you going to be all right? And I assured them through hand signals that I would be okay. And I don't know how long I was there, 20 minutes, 45 minutes, another hour. I was really, really drunk. And I managed to stagger to my feet and to take the long way home. You know, I got the swerve going, you know. It's about a half mile to my parents' house. And Joe and Fran, my parents, are asleep upstairs. Now it's about 2 or 3 in the morning. And my four siblings are asleep in our beautiful suburban home, I would say lower middle class house in suburban New Jersey. We're Irish Catholic, CIA, Catholic Irish alcoholic. Wherever three or four are gathered, there will be a fifth. And so there's, I'm the oldest, Joseph, Patrick, Marianne, Kathleen, and James, and we're all there. Sugar the Cocker Spaniel lives with us, and the drunken eldest son comes staggering through the door. Quietly, I go down to the basement because I decide I want to listen to some music, all right? So I go down to the basement instead of going to bed, and I put on a little Neil Young, you know, and I turned it all the way up. You know, I dropped the needle, you know. Remember we used to do that? We dropped that needle. And I'm jamming. I got my headphones on, and I'm jamming. After about 10 minutes, my mother comes downstairs and says, you forgot to plug in the headphones. Oh, sorry, Mom. Go to bed. And I knew not to say anything because my speech would be slurred and I was afraid of what might come out of my mouth. So I eventually staggered up to bed and I went to bed. And do you know when I came to the next day? There was no problem. There was not a problem. Came to probably 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and there was no problem whatsoever. That was just partying hardy, right? It was the 70s, I had the longer hair, you know, and so in our book, the great book, Alcoholics Anonymous, our great medical friend, Dr. Silkworth, William Silkworth, 1878 to 1951, another New Jersey guy, he says this about us. He says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless they can once again experience the sense of ease and comfort that comes from that comes at once by taking a few drinks they see others taking with impunity. Once they succumb to the desire, as so many do, And once they succumb to the desire, as so many do, and what is it? Once they come to the desire, as so many do, and hold on. It's right here.
once they come to the desire, then it's going to do.
And the phenomenon of craving
develops.
Once they succumb to the desire, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known series of sprees. I love you. I love you. I love you. They pass through the well-known series of sprees, emerging remorseful. I'm remorseful. With a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. This is repeated over and over. This is repeated over and over. This is repeated over and over and over and over. And unless this person experiences an entire psychic change, there is little hope for this person's recovery. So that was Joe B's story. When we circle back to the kid who's passed out in front of Bart Finnegan's bar, there was no hope for my recovery because I had no interest in recovery. I wanted to party. I wanted to drink. I wanted to feel different. I wanted to change the way I felt. And so I went and did that for the next 13 years. So I drank from 1972 to 1989, August 28th, 1989, I had a 17-year one-man cocktail party where a lot of people passed through, but nobody was really invited. It was really about Joe B catching a buzz, getting comfortable with Joe B being Joe B. Now, I've got to confess to you some things about Joe B. Joe B did not have a good impression of himself. Joe B had low self-esteem. Joe B had low self-esteem. Looking back in 2020 hindsight, with sobriety, with self-examination, with sponsorship, with long talks over coffee with other alcoholics, why did Joe B have low self-esteem? He had two loving parents who really did love each other, and I know that's such a great gift in the world when you have two parents who love each other, and our home was marinated in love. That's really all kids need, is a home marinated in love, and I was marinated in love. People loved me, and I knew they loved me, and I loved them, and it was good, you know. But Joe B had low self-esteem, felt bad about himself, poor self-image. Why is this, Joe B? Well, I'm going to report to you something that you'll never hear another local television news anchorman report to you. And this is part of why I had low self-esteem. Joe B peed in the bed from zero to age 12, and I outgrew it. I do want you to know, if for some reason we have a sleepover, do not be alarmed. I did outgrow it. But when you wake up like that every day for the first 12 years of your life, and your parents are begging you to please cut this out, and you just keep going and going and going with it, and you just don't, you have a bad self-image from the start of every day. And so I did that. And then, you know, I was hot in school. I was a really good student right through second grade. And I had the same second grade teacher as my father had in second grade. And this lady loved me, and I was marinated in love in that classroom. It was awesome. But third grade, man, it was just a different world, and I just didn't do well in school. I didn't want to go to school. I didn't want to be there, you know. I was one of those guys. And so one thing led to another, and I grew up. And I grew up in a beautiful family where there was drinking, but not alcoholic drinking. My mother and father split a Ballantine, Rheingold, or Schaefer 12-ounce beer for dinner every night. You ever hear of that? I mean, I don't know anybody else who did that. Oh, I've had a little too much, honey. Split that beer. And then my my parents would have cocktail parties at the house on like Saturdays, and their friends would come over and they'd have dinner and listen to records or stuff like that. It was all really harmless, very friendly. The police department never came to our house. We never had that. They never came one time. There was no reason for them to be there. They had no reason. But man, I got this Joe B poor self-image going, and I couldn't wait to get to the drinks. So by the time we're stealing liquor out of our father's liquor cabinets and I'm down in the woods with the boys, it was, oh yeah, I love the effect produced by alcohol. That is wonderful. And so I took it as far as I could take it. And I want to give you just a few snapshots of what Joe B. was like as a drunk. Joe B. was a pass-out, blackout kind of guy. I blacked out pretty often, pretty frequently. I passed out in all kinds of places. I passed out in flower beds, on front porches, back porches, backyards, front yards. I passed out in every room of every house that we ever lived in. I, passed out one time. I drank some Irish whiskey one night, and I end up passing out in the back of a Datsun 240Z. Now, you really have to get in the fetal position. I'm a 6'2 guy in the 200-pound club. You really have to kind of scrunch up. And when I came to out of that one, I just couldn't imagine how that started. You know, must have been drunk. Did that kind of thing. One thing led to another, you know, like that. I was very lucky in attracting a member of the opposite sex who ultimately married me for reasons that, you know, she really needs to go into counseling for. But this woman and I are still together, and she's really been through the ringer, all right? She's a Memphis girl and Memphis parents and all that. And so I winked at her one day in astronomy class in college at Christian Brothers, then college, now university. And now we've had two kids go through that school. We've been blessed with two sons. They're now ages 23 and 20. My number two boy is going through there now. So we dated for a while, and then we started, you know, kind of living together. And then ultimately in 1983, we got married. But during my alcoholism, one of the things that old Joe B. does when he has a few drinks is, you know, as you heard me say during Dr. Silkworth's piece there, on the well-known series of sprees, I tend to fall in love rather quickly. And, you know, the old Crosby, Stills, Nash song was "Love the One You're With." And so I would kind of do that. And like Bill W., frequently, you know, there was no real unfaithfulness due to extreme alcoholism. I was just too drunk to do anything about it. But to give you a snapshot of one of the things that happened, I was down in Sandestin, Florida a few years ago, and I was at Buster's. Anybody been to Buster's meeting in Sandestin? It's in a bar in Sandestin, Florida, 8 a.m. every day. And it's a great AA meeting because there's a lot of retired military, recovered alcoholics. There's a lot of people on vacation, and there's just a lot of good AA members who come to Buster's in Sandestin, Florida at the restaurant bar meeting, and it's quite a big meeting. And I was in there, you know, sharing at an open discussion meeting, and this blonde woman kind of caught my eye, and she was paying particular attention to what I was saying, and I kind of picked up on that. And after the meeting, she walked over to me and said, "You mean you don't remember who I am?" That's a scary statement. Coming from a blackout, kind of drunk, I said, "I'm sorry, who are you?" And she proceeded to advise me of how before I was married, we fell in love at the Memphis and May International Barbecue Cooking Contest in about 1981, and there was a little kissy face down there along the Mississippi River, and I followed her and escorted her back to the Peabody Hotel where she had a room. And she invited me not to accompany her to her room, but I somehow got around the security guard she invited to keep me from getting up to her room. And unfortunately, when I knocked on the door, there was no response, and I proceeded to pass out right in front of her hotel door, right there in the hallway. And so I was enjoying a restful nap right there in the Peabody in the hallway there. And she says she was in the shower and came out in her bathrobe and found me because she thought she heard something, sprawled out on the floor, and she had pity on me. And then she said, quote, "I dragged you by your ankles down to my next door neighbor's room where my girlfriend and her husband had a room with their child, and you stayed," and then it all started to come back. It all started to come back. I remembered awakening or coming to on the kind of the entrance area of a hotel room with the W from the welcome mat embossed into my cheek. And, you know, this family sitting up in bed pointing, And I just did, hey, how y'all doing? Good to see you. Have a great day. And I hit the door, you know. And so the next thing, you know, I can give you another snapshot of Joby in action. You know, it was there was all kinds of stuff like this that happened, you know. And as long as we're talking about the, you know, the sex part, you know, in our step four, we're invited to inventory our resentments, our fear, and our sex conduct. And I had a real hard time doing that. I was one of these guys who really didn't want to write any of that material down because I considered it personal information. It was none of your business, thank you very much. But I have a friend from Vancouver named Sean who does it like this. He tells it like this. He says, you know, you come to, and then you look over and say, oh, that's not my drapes over there. And you look at the ceiling and you say, that's not my ceiling. And then you look over here, and, oops, that's not my wife. And the way Sean tells it, okay, and I won't hurt you, I promise, he says, it is still asleep. And so you quietly get up and you get your clothes and you tiptoe to the bathroom. And you take care of your business and wash your face and say, I'm not going to have an emotional reaction to this. And without saying anything to it, you bolt, right? Well, if you keep doing the kind of things Joe B used to do, eventually you come to and those are not your drapes and that's not your ceiling and it is not your wife and it has awakened before you did. And you've become it. Yeah. Well, I had that it stuff, okay? I had some of that going on, all right? So I was doing that. So that's a snapshot of Joe B, all right? And so I'm falling in love too many places and inappropriately and that sort of thing and messing around like that. And that's just where I go when I put alcohol in my system. That's just what happens. And so I don't know who I came here to speak to today. I know some of the people who are here, you know, sober since the Civil War. You know, I mean, you know, so, but there's somebody probably here who might need to hear something like that, you know, and that's part of my deal, you know. And so it's my experience in our program working with other guys. I work with a lot of low-bottom guys and people from prison and that kind of stuff. And it's my experience with men. Now, women have a best friend, or their mom, or a girlfriend, they tell on themselves. My wife's Cosmopolitan magazine says women have 50,000 more words a day than men, all right? But guys, right, we don't tell a lot of this stuff. We are just not naturally inclined to telling on ourselves like that, and especially about personal sex information. And so it's my experience in working with guys that they'll get to step one, good, two, fine, three, okay, we'll do that. Four, self-examination, you're asking too much. See you later, alligator, that's too hard. I can't do it. I can't. And I was the same way, as I'll tell you later. I was the same, very same way. I'm going to take a commercial break now from the newscast and go into a little AA history moment because I'm an AA history buff. I received a very beautiful gift from an AA member from New Albany, Mississippi, who was one of my deputy sponsors, a lady named Martha H. And her husband, Buddy H., were very handy people. And they went around the AA world. They went to 855 Ardmore Avenue in Akron. They went up to the Wilson House, where Bill Wilson was born in East Dorset, Vermont. They went to Stepping Stones, Bedford Hills, New York. And they did all kinds of work on those properties, not for any kind of pay, just as service to our great fellowship, because they had the time and the money and the ability and the great gifts and skills to do that. And as a thank you to them, these places often gave them little trinkets that became AA treasure to those of us who love the program. And so I brought some along. And this is a piece of slate that the holders received up at East Dorset, Vermont, where Bill Wilson was born, okay? And it says here, William Griffith Wilson was born in this house. This is a piece of slate from the roof where Wilson was born, on November 26, 1895. This shingle was quarried a few miles west of the Wilson house. This is a slate shingle from the Wilson house located at the corner of Mad Tom Road and Village Street in East Dorset, Vermont. The shingle is estimated to be 150 years old. And Martha gave this to me for my 14th AA birthday in 2003, and she wrote, "The will of God will never lead you where the grace of God cannot keep you. Peace and love, Martha H." Okay? And so what a gift, huh? What a gift to be given this. And I keep this in my God spot at home. Buddy framed it and painted. Buddy was so handy, he built his own casket, freaked Martha out, did it in the basement. He was just wired like that, okay? But he wrote one of our AA mottos, "First Things First," right here on the front of the thing. And I keep this in my God spot where I pray every morning and every night at home. I got a cool little room that I go to. It's sort of like my little chapel meditation room, and I pray. And I got to praying one day, why does Joe B. have this piece? Why do I have part of Bill Wilson's roof in my house or when I'm on the road in my car? Why does Joe B.? I prayed and asked HP, "Hey, Father, tell me, why do I have, give me a clue." And I got an answer. I want you to know I got an answer. And I have to ask a question before I tell you what the answer was. Is there anybody here with 6 months or less sobriety? Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome, welcome, welcome. And you know what? It really doesn't matter how much time you have. It really and truly doesn't. You know, it's all about being sober right now. If we stay sober right now, you know, the rest is going to take care of itself. We just got to take care of right now. So I asked, why do I have Bill Wilson's roof? And here's the answer that I got. It's for people like you, to welcome people like you and to let you know that we're all under the same roof. You know, like Milton's been sober since the Civil War, right? There's people here who've been sober since, you know, forever, right? And they and we need you at least or more than you need us. You need us just as much as we need you. We all need each other. And so what this is all about, this thing here is about our legacies of unity. We're all under the same roof. We who've been around a few 24 hours have to get back into that book that we all quote so often so we can remember what it says, so we can find new aspects of sobriety and new blessings and all new kinds of wisdom that's right there for us. And every time we open that book, tell me it's not true. Every time we open that book, I find some new facet. When I'm reading and paying any kind of attention, there's something new. There's a nuance that I find to it. And you need us because you need to know that there was a time when we had one day, every one of us here. Each one of us had one day of sobriety. Every single one of us straggled through that door and came across that threshold. And we know exactly how that feels. We know how it feels to have less than 6 months of sobriety in a group full. All these people have been sober since, you know, the caveman were running around in AA world, you know, right? I mean, so we know what that feels like. We want you to feel welcome. We want you to feel right at home here with us. And we want to say to you, stay. Stay with us. Stay with us. Hang with us. Stay under this roof. In our program, we have these three legacies of unity, recovery, and service. And the circle in the triangle, circle is the whole AA world. And the triangle is unity, recovery, and service. That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. So I want to welcome you to AA. And that's the end of the commercial. Now we'll get back to the Joe B. story. So Joe B., give you another snapshot. Joe B. lives in Memphis, Tennessee. Joe B. gets to become a television news guy. And through the grace of God, I started with that station on January 28th, 1978, and I'm with the same station and been there ever since. I'm part of the furniture on local TV in Memphis, right? And so you know who the most famous citizen of Memphis was, Elvis Aaron Presley, the king of rock and roll, who died on August 16th, 1977. And every five-year multiple of his death, we have many, many thousands who flock to Graceland to honor the king, you know. They come every year, but especially on those five-year multiples. We just celebrated 35 years of Elvis since his death-iversary, all right? And so on his 10th death-iversary, in 1987, the TV station said, well, there's going to be a big crowd, and we want to send you out there to Graceland. And every half hour on the half hour, we want you to give us a report about what's going on, tell us some of the activities for about 30 seconds, all right? And I said, well, great, that's great, but you're making me work on my day off? Yeah, I know, it's a Saturday. I said, well, all right. So I go out there on Saturday, August 15th, and that night the candlelight vigil is about to begin at midnight, and the streams of Elvis, especially women, fans with the mascara running, will parade up the driveway and go through the gates and all that and honor Elvis. Well, there I am that day, and as you know, in Memphis, it's hot in August. And it's August 15th, and August 15th, 1987. And so I'm standing out there, and I do a report at 9:30 a.m., and I'm going to be there every half hour on the half hour right through 6 o'clock that evening. And so out of the blue, out of nowhere, a forklift comes over the horizon, and it's coming my way. And a pallet is on that forklift with a 55-gallon drum, and in that 55-gallon drum, there's a trash liner. And in that trash liner, there's ice, and inside that ice, there's hundreds of cans of the greatest product from Anheuser-Busch. And the forklift driver lowers the pallet directly next to my position, says, Joe, this is for the media, backs up his forklift and drives away. And I'm the only media for 500 yards. And it's Saturday, it's my day off. It's hot. It's Memphis in August. There's not a hotter place in the United States, hardly. And so I held off for about a half an hour, 45 minutes. And then alcoholism kicked in. And you may be wondering, Joe, if you got sober on August 28th, 1989, and you came to work at Channel 5 on January 28th, 1978, that's an 11-year span. Were you ever drunk on the air? And the answer is, yes, I was. And this was the day, August 15th, 1987. And let me tell you, I was fine just for, you know, Dr. Silkworth says, we can have a few drinks, right? Few drinks, I was fine with a few drinks. But unfortunately, my alcoholism kicked in. And so at around 3 o'clock, I did a little Kentucky rain. And then around 4 o'clock, I was on to Suspicious Minds, and on 5 o'clock, baby, I was in the ghetto. I was a hot mess out there. That truly did happen. I did that right there at Elvis Presley's Graceland. And somehow or another, they didn't fire me. I got away with it. I guess they weren't watching. I don't know. But so I survived all that. So anyway, to wrap up my drunkalogue and get on to the recovery, where all the blessings have been just flying. What happened to me was I've invited my wife to go to a movie with me. It was a movie called The Empire of the Sun. And this is also in 1987, a couple of years before I quit drinking through the grace of God. And so in 1987, we go to see this movie. It's a three-hour movie, a long movie. And I convinced my wife to go to Midway Cafe on Poplar Avenue in Memphis, which is right across from where the Malco Quartet used to be, movie theater. And I convinced her that we needed to go to the movie about an hour early, and my ulterior motive was to get in that bar and have about 6 to 7 drinks for a three-hour movie. I figured that's how many I'd need. And so I drank 3 or 4 drinks in her presence, and when she went to the bathroom or was looking the other way, I ran up to the bar and had a couple more, you know. So that's the kind of stuff I was doing, you know, right in front of her. And we went to the movie, and the movie started just like an average movie always does. Lights got dim, and the movie came on, and another movie played in my mind's eye. This was a really amazing event that's only happened this one time to me, so, you know, I'm not really that crazy. And the movie I saw was about my inappropriate behavior, that it stuff I talked about a moment ago, you know, the sex conduct. I was really super embarrassed because I had grown up in this beautiful family with these parents who really loved each other. I was marinated in love, and I knew my behavior was totally inappropriate. And my conscience played me this movie of this behavior, you know? And I had awakened so many times with that, with all that, those feelings that we have, the four horsemen. Well, they were really present. The four horsemen were just totally, totally on me. And that sense of doom that we have, yeah, that was there. That was visiting that particular movie theater. Incomprehensible and pitiful demoralization that I had wakened with so many times, it just all rushed on to me right there, man. And I looked at my behavior. And even though I had had a bunch of drinks, I was kind of almost, I had a cold sweat. My wife asked me, "Are you okay?" I was, "Oh, yeah, just watching a movie." And I'm seeing a totally different film than she's seeing in my mind's eye. The next day, because I'm a Catholic kid, I went to the cathedral and I went to confession. And I stood in line like we do, Catholic people do, you know, and you go in and see the priest. And in the movies, they always have it, you know, you're in the boxes and you can't identify and it's all anonymous. But the way it really is today, you can still do that, but the way it generally is today, it's face-to-face. It's like talking with your sponsor. It's kind of like that. And so I'm looking this guy in the face, and I'd never seen him before. And he said, "I just got off the plane from Chicago, and I just got here a half hour ago. Now, what is this?" And I started telling him some of my stuff, right? He says, "Hold on right there. And tell me about your drinking again." And I tell him briefly about my, "Yeah, I drink too much." He says, "Now I know why I got off the plane a half hour ago from Chicago. I really didn't feel like being here today. But now I know why I'm supposed to be here. I'm an alcoholic. Son, the church welcomes you home. We love you very, very much, but for alcoholism, we go to AA." I got 12-stepped in the confessional. That's where I got 12-stepped. You talk about a God thing, that's where it happened for me. I got 12-stepped in a confessional. And this guy told me some of his story. I mean, you know how we do, you know? He's going to confession to me. He's telling me all his stuff. And he says, "Look, you really need to investigate AA. That's where it's at." And so it was 2 more years before I took him up on his suggestion. I had to go out and dance with the bear some more, and I had to get in trouble at work because I was still passing out in all these public places. And finally work said, "You know, come on, man. I mean, you're not drinking on the air, but we hear what you're doing out in the community, and, you know, it's not cool." And so one day I went to a bachelor party, and I ended up passing out. I won't go into the whole thing. But I'm passed out in the bar. I lost my wallet. So the bartender and the waiter had mercy on me, put me in a cab. A cop came and escorted the cab with me, the corpse, in the back to my TV station. They woke up the DJ who was on the all-night FM station, which was located at our TV station, and they called my boss at about 4 a.m, who had promised this kind of thing would never happen again, to find out my address so they could take me home. And my wife was at home about 4 a.m, and she had our newborn son, who was then 3 months old, and the cops carried me in, and I was totally passed out, and they carried me like a log. You know, I am in the 200-pound club, so there's 3 of them, and one had me from like the torso, one had the middle, and one had the legs. And I came to as I was coming over the threshold, and my wife was sitting on the arm of our best chair with our newborn baby. And I said, "Honey, I'm home." And the cops thought that was hilarious. And they threw me on the bed. You know, she didn't even smile. She did not even smile. Anyway, that was very close to the end. I promised myself I wouldn't drink, but I had bought the beer for the wedding reception. I had to drink that. And then the Sunday, when all the guys were going back to the airport, oh, I promised myself I wouldn't drink that day. But I did a farewell tour with the guys, and we went around saying goodbye to everybody. And you know what your friends do from college and everything? "Well, Joe, would you like a beer?" And I promised myself I wouldn't drink it. I knew I was in trouble for work. I knew my wife asked me not to drink. I promised myself I wouldn't drink it. But that hand went out there, and I could not drink that beer. That, my brothers and sisters, is alcoholism. And I drank, and I went and got rip-roaring drunk. The next day, I went in to face my boss, and I'm trying to get my best Joe B. look going in the bathroom. You know how it is when you're getting called on the carpet. You want to be smooth, you know, be cool and everything. Be ready to go. And he walks into the bathroom right when I'm trying to get it together. And I preempted him. I said, "Can I see you in your office?" He said, "Yeah, you can." So I went in there and fired myself. And he said, "Son, we're not firing you. We want to know what's wrong with you." As if they didn't know, right? And I said, "Well, I think I might have a problem with drinking." And they said, "No. You? Really? Really? What do you think we should do about this? What do you prescribe as the plan?" And they had me write out a plan, okay, a proactive, very corporate plan, what Joe B. is going to do about a drinking problem. And the plan was this: I will go to AA. If that doesn't work, I will go to a treatment center. I signed it, and as far as I know, it's still in my personnel file. And I turned it in, and as far as I know, it's still in my personnel file. And it's the finest plan I ever wrote. Somebody else wrote it, and it's still working today, one day at a time, 23 years later, through the grace of God and you people and this loving higher power of ours, one day at a time. But I went to Central Group in Memphis because I had given a hitchhiker. Remember we used to have hitchhikers, right? Remember hitchhikers before the cult movies and the serial killer movies? We had hitchhikers. And so I used to be the kind of guy who would take a hitchhiker all the way to where he was going. And this guy had a big book in his hand one day, and he said, "Here you go. This is my book. Check it out. I'm giving this hitchhiker." "Well, son, I can't look at a book. I'm driving you. What kind of book is it?" "Well, this book is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to a big book study, and it's right down here at Central Group at Cooper and Young." And I said, "Well, good luck, buddy." And for the next 10 years, that happened in 1979, for the next 10 years, I had this lingering notion I was headed your way here in AA, and I would drive by, "Hey, AA!" I would drive by drunk, "I'm coming! I just can't get there yet!" And so I knew where to go when it was time to get here, and I walked in, and man, I thought I was really, you know, being a legend in my own mind, right, because I'm on the local news. I thought, I'll be splashed across the front page of the alternative paper in town, "Newsman Alcoholic," and they'll have a picture of me coming out of this place. So I had my best, you know, disguise on. I had my shades, my ball cap pulled way down. I went in with my head down, you know. And I found out that we don't have the paparazzi in Memphis. They just don't care about Memphis. So, you know, want to talk about a second step issue. I mean, crazy. So I got there, finally. I'm in AA. They gave me a newcomer reading. They welcomed me. And I mean, literally from the first minute when I stepped in the door, I felt like I was home. And after about 3 days, I felt like I had a good feeling in my stomach, in my gut. This thing can work for me. I knew I was in the right place. I identified because y'all were telling me my story. I mean, your story and my story. You were ringing so many bells. So I stuck around and I made my first conference, the Bluff City Fellowship, in October of 1989. I was blown away that we have these things, you know. Just incredible, you know, the energy and the love and the just great AA love, the language of the heart. Oh, it was just awesome. And so I heard a speaker talk about the importance of sponsorship, and I'm 60 days in. And so I went and got the guy that I respected the most, that I really liked what he was saying. It was John, who had his own business, John H. He had 3 years, which to me seemed like an eternity, an unbelievable amount of sobriety. And John and I just related to what John said. And so John had his own business and would come to the meeting. Before the meeting, he would make the noon meeting, and then we would frequently go to lunch. So I was spending a lot of time with John, okay? And I never told anybody what was going on with Joe B. I mean, never. I didn't know you could do that. I swear I didn't do that. I just never really told anybody what was really going on in here, ever. I just never, ever, really, ever did it. And so John, being a good sponsor, is trying to open the door to Joe B. And I mean, would open it maybe 0.1%. I was afraid. I was afraid to reveal to people who I really was, you know, fearing rejection, I guess. I don't know. So It took a while for me to get going. And then John said, you know, Joe, what we do is what a sponsor is supposed to help you through the steps. So we need to work the steps together. And I said, well, John, as I analyze the steps, and I look at those 12 suggestions, and they are just suggestions that you guys have up there. And I've been auditing the course here now, and I have been obtaining through osmosis through my skin and static cling from being near you people, that good static cling, you know, you get from the dryer. I have been obtaining my kind of sobriety through the auditing of these meetings. And therefore, and as I analyze the steps, I believe I need step 9. I think I have definite amends to make. And step 11, I will pray, and I think that's going to be good for me. And that's going to be the Joe B. Freestyle AA system. And John said, keep coming back. And so Joe B., I'm embarrassed to tell you, from August of 89, all the way through 89, all the way through 90, into the spring of 91, 19 months dry, Joe B. did not work any steps, formally, in AA. But I was present every day. I was at the meeting before the meeting. I even chaired meetings on the steps. I even went to lunch every day with my sponsor. And I started to open the Joe B. door of what was going on in Joe B.'s heart, 1%, 2%. But I didn't tell very much, you know. So the night comes where the wine is being poured at the candlelight. Old friends, beautiful wife. I've been a good boy for 19 months, no messing around. I forgot to tell you, remember Sade, that song, Smooth Operator, right? Smooth Operator, coast to coast. That was not me. I was a mess. But I'd been a good boy for 19 months, and they're pouring the wine, and just like Jim with the whiskey and the milk, I thought, what could it hurt? I said, this is AA amateur hour here. This is just wine. I can have this. And I nearly drank again. I came this close. And I excused myself from the table. I snapped out of it through the grace of God. I walked outside. I started pacing and smoking. I was still smoking then. At Central Group back in those days, you couldn't see the speaker because there was too much smoke, right? We were all smoking. I smoked those Vantage cigarettes with the old butthole in them, you know, and I'm smoking. For your health, you know. They were less tar and nicotine. And I was out there pacing, and the next day, I locked myself in a conference room and wrote that fourth step with all that it stuff that I wouldn't talk about, and I typed it. You know, I'm a perfectionist, so it was beautiful. I mean, you know, a professor would have given me, you know, just on style and turning it. I mean, it was a gorgeous piece of paper, and it was a lot of paper, and it got good to me. I prayed before I did it. I got in there, and it was an all-day thing where I poured this thing out. And then it got good to me. I started, oh, yeah, I remember this and that. And then we, you know, got the fears, and we got the resentments, and then that sex stuff, and I just laid it all out there. And I called my sponsor. I said, John, Joe B. Joe, how you doing, buddy? It's Sunday afternoon. Joe B. Yeah, Joe, what's going on, man? He said, what's going on with you? I said, well, John, I just wrote a fourth step, and I swear to God, he dropped the phone. He said, is this Joe B. from the Central Group? Yeah. Yeah, that Joe B. He and his girlfriend thought I was drinking. He said, we thought you were drinking. We saw you coming by Fridays the other day, and we could have sworn you had been in there and you'd been drinking. But I wasn't. I didn't drink. And so I told him, you know, man, I want to do my fourth step, but I've already told this priest a whole lot of this stuff, and is it all right if I do it with him? And so he said, yeah. Then I called the priest, and the priest said, is it all right with your sponsor? Make sure you're finished with your fourth step. And so check with him. And I kind of went through that motion a little bit. And then I went to see the priest. So I'm driving over to see the priest. We made an appointment for like the Wednesday of that week. So it's like 3 days between steps 4 and 5. And I'm driving Joe B.'s Joe B. Mobile. And I start getting like this. I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't cop to all this stuff. I'm not about to tell anybody all this material. I mean, this is scandalous. This is so embarrassing. This is so just horrible. What an incredible behavior. And I swear to you, I heard a voice say to me, just like I'm talking to you, you better go do this. You, Joby, better go do this. And I'm not saying somebody else took over my car and drove my car to that church rectory, but something happened. Another power took over. And I walked into that place. This guy had told his secretary, don't disturb us unless there's an emergency. He drew the curtains. He had a cauldron of coffee just like you do here in the party room. He had a jumbo box of Kleenex because he knew we'd need them from prior experience with me confessing stuff to him. And we had a 3.5 hour come to Jesus fifth step where I shared it all. And I want to give you guys a secret. If you have stuff that you have yet to share on how you can do it, when I got to the real embarrassing it stuff, I took that paper and I dug my face in there and I read it off to him just cold like that. And he didn't get up and scream and run out the door and leave the building. He just listened compassionately, and then he shared some of his challenges with me and some of his fourth step material with me. This went on for, you know, almost 4 hours. And that's the day I joined AA. That's the day I joined your organization. That's the day I started really working steps. You know, and I moved on through the steps, and I moved on, and, you know, when I reread the big book, I pray before I do it, show me what I really need to see. And one of the times I did that, I got to see that second step. Because you remember Evelyn Wood speed reading? I read that second step as an Evelyn Wood speed reader. Came to believe. I didn't even finish the whole step, sentence. Came to believe. Well, I believe in God. I didn't have a problem with believing in God. So what's that step? Got it. Got that one. Well, when I came back around and read about Jim with the whiskey and the milk, and read about the jaywalker, and this happening over and over and over again, oh, God, it resonated. I was crazy when I was out there. I was so, so, so crazy. And then, you know, we move on with the steps. I've taken a numerous formal third steps with my sponsor in groups. I just need to retool and redo it with great frequency. I've done new fourth steps and fifth steps. And then 6 and 7, our friend Sandy B. has a story he likes to tell about 6 and 7 that I like to steal. Let me check the time before I go too much longer. You know, a young boy is a little league pitcher, and he's getting ready for a big game, and his coach says, son, get a good night's sleep before you go to, you know, when you go to bed tonight, because we need you to play well tomorrow. And this relates to 6 and 7. Hang in with me. So the kid goes to sleep at about 8 o'clock, but about midnight, he awakens with a toothache. There's a twinging there. And he doesn't call his mother and let her know. He just lays there and tries to go back to sleep, can't go back to sleep, tosses and turns for like an hour and a half, finally calls his mother. Mother gets an aspirin or two. Kid goes back to sleep about 2 in the morning. Next day, doesn't pitch as well as he might have because he didn't get a good night's sleep. Why didn't the kid call his mother immediately to get the aspirin? And Sandy says, it's because the kid knew his mother, and his mother would call the dentist the next week. And the dentist would dig down in there and investigate the root causes of this kid's tooth pain. And, you know, they get in there and they twist around and do things you never thought of, and you wonder, why am I even here? This is crazy. This hurts. Well, that's 6 and 7. I love the way Sandy describes that. And, you know, man, my character defects and my shortcomings are too long to list. But that's what it's like for me in doing battle with them. I don't want to do it. You know, I got over my people-pleasing tonight. I didn't get a birdhouse. But I got a small kit of spiritual tools that were laid at my feet, and there's nothing left for me to do but pick them up. I moved on with the steps, made that list to make amends, and made direct amends, and then I love 10 where we keep the house clean, and 11 I do pray every night and every morning, and 12 I work in the prison and I carry the message to the prison. I'm so proud of our prison work in AA. I went to the International in San Antonio. I went to Toronto in 2005, but I loved what we did as an organization in San Antonio. You know, we gave AA Comes of Age in softback because one prisoner at San Quentin requested from New York, can I please have this in softback? I can't read, you know, they don't let the hardback books into the prisons. And because one letter, one AA member wrote from a prison in California, we have AA Comes of Age in softback. And so what I did was I focused my energies at this conference at our international last time on all of the corrections meetings. And so I attended them. And there was one that was spectacular. When these three women who go into prisons were talking, and one of them asked, how many of you here, and there were 5,000 people in one of these really large rooms in San Antonio, how many of you here go into the prisons? 99% of the hands went up. And it was unity, recovery, and service palpable. I could feel it. I could feel us. I could feel the circle and the triangle. I was so proud, you know. And I go to the correction center in Shelby County, and I've been going there for 6 years, carrying the meeting out there on Thursday nights, for many Thursday nights. And a lot of times I don't want to go, and I'll walk out of there after having the meeting, and I'll be lifted up, and I'm walking on air out of that place. And I got to tell you one quick story as I wrap up tonight. There was this thing that I do on TV called Taking Back Our Neighborhoods. It's very AA solution oriented, where it's our response as a TV station to crime. We have a lot of that, unfortunately, in Memphis. Problem properties, we have a lot of blight too. And other threats to healthy neighborhoods, okay? So I do these stories about solution-oriented people who are doing something about it. One time, one of my viewers, my bank teller, said, Joe Birch, I want you to do something about taking back my neighborhood. I said, what's going on? This lady was an African-American lady who lived in the Orange Mound neighborhood in Memphis, which is a huge, huge African-American neighborhood, and her grandmother had bought a house in 1932. Think about that. During the Great Depression, this woman was able to buy a house in 1932, and it's been the family home ever since. And there's a crack house across the street. I want you to do something about it. She says she's called the sheriff, she's called the police, she's called code enforcement, the mayor, everybody there is to call dozens of times, yet they board it up, they put the plywood on there, and you know, we come along, tear the plywood off, and continue the party, right? So I went to the crack house with the camera, right? And we opened the back door, and it's everything you'd want a crack house to be, cinematically, okay? There's a knife chillingly stabbed into the hardwood floor. It's filthy. There's evidence of drug abuse, all the syringes, and there's evidence of used prophylactics. There's bottles and cans everywhere. It's absolutely filthy. And then we heard some snoring, snoring. Somebody was at home at the crack house. So we tiptoed in, and sure enough, there was this guy snoring. I called him Mr. Sleepy, and then we found Mr. Sleepy in our, and his dog snoring in the crack house, sleeping in there, in Memphis, Tennessee, on Grand Street near Park Avenue in Orange Mound. Well, years go by, and there's a guy on the front row at the Thursday night AA meeting, and he says, hey, Joe, I'm Mr. Sleepy. And I said, well, you know, take a seat, sir. Nice to meet you, Mr. Sleepy. I forget about the story, you know. Nice to have you. And he says, no, you don't understand. I'm Mr. Sleepy. And he had found out about the story when he went to the liquor store, and they told him and were laughing about him and all that. Now you're looking at Mr. Sleepy's sponsor. That's how God works, right? That's how God works. And so Terry has 3 years of continuous sobriety. He has his first job in 10 years. He's been promoted. He's been continuously employed now as a dishwasher at the Peabody Hotel for 1 year. In December, it'll be 1 year. What a miracle to be a witness to, thanks to our blessed program, you know. And so, you know, it goes on in the doctor's opinion to say, you know, after our whole experience of being drunks, it says that, strange as it may sound to those who do not understand, once a person has had a psychic change, who seemed doomed, who seemed completely unable to solve any of his problems, once he has this psychic change, he becomes able to stay away from alcohol as long as he follows a few simple rules. And condensed, those simple rules are what? Trust God, clean house, serve others. And one day at a time, through the grace of God, we'll keep doing that. God bless the Mont Eagle Roundup, and God bless AA. Thank you for listening to me.